Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Stephanie Lecce, sitting in for Don Marsh. We're devoting today's entire program to look back at a dark period of American history, the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. This Sunday, February 19th, marks the 75th year since President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. This order paved the way for the American military to remove Americans of Japanese ancestry from the west coast of the U.S. to internment camps scattered across the country. It was a fearful reaction to the attack on Pearl Harbor 2 months prior and displaced some 110,000 Japanese Americans from 1942 to 1944. Some of those people eventually made their way to St. Louis. Joining me in studio are Suzanne Sakahara, a retired Lindenwood University professor who, at age 6, was sent with her family to live in an internment camp in California, eventually leaving for farm work in Montana and landing in St. Louis. Rob Miyasaka is a playwright and drama teacher at Wydown Middle School. He's working on a series of plays about the Japanese-American experience during and after World War II. He's also digitally archiving a trove of oral histories from St. Louisans who lived through Japanese internment. And Rebecca Copeland is a professor of Japanese language and literature at Washington University. She knows about the special part the university played in keeping some Japanese-American students from life at an internment camp. Thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Rebecca, let's start by having you briefly describe what anti-Japanese sentiment there was in the U.S. prior to the attack on Pearl Harbor and how that escalated afterward. How did this set the stage for Executive Order 9066?
Well, I think that Japanese Americans had been playing a very important role in the West Coast economy. But there had been a history of immigration bans against Japanese Americans or against Japanese immigration. And first-generation Japanese who immigrated to the United States were not allowed to own land, the land that they worked. They were not allowed to naturalize, and many were not allowed to keep their savings in banks. Their children, however, were entitled to the privileges of American citizens, having been born in the United States. But their success, I think, invited animosity and jealousy amongst others living on the West Coast. So when the attack occurred, it was an opportune moment for many of these voices to express fear of Japanese Americans.
And how did that then play into the executive order that President Roosevelt would put out? How did we get from that kind of prejudice and maybe hysteria after the attack to that executive order?
Well, I think there was a tremendous amount of pressure from West Coast politicians in particular, the governor of California, the mayor of Los Angeles. They all lobbied very heavy to President Roosevelt to enforce this executive order. They were met by Lieutenant General DeWitt, who was responsible for the Western sphere, and he had extraordinary racial bias against Japanese Americans. And the pressure was too great for Roosevelt to withstand, and so he put forward the executive order, despite the fact that J. Edgar Hoover, who was the director of the FBI at the time, said there was no need for it.
I'm going to open this up to the rest of the panel here. Was there any sense within the Japanese American community that something like this could occur? Was there any, I guess, anticipation of an executive order like this?
No, but there was, you know, trepidation and fear. And I was a child. I was only 6 years old. But I remember that in our community, which was Vashon Island, between Tacoma and Seattle, that all the parents were saying to each other, burn anything that's Japanese, letters, newspapers, records, any souvenirs you have, anything that has something to do with Japan. She said, get rid of it.
So we've been hearing a lot about executive orders lately and what they can do and what they cannot do. How did this executive order actually work? How did it roll out?
Well, I think that Japanese Americans and Japanese immigrants on the West Coast were given very little warning about what to expect, and sometimes less than 48 hours to collect all their baggage, sell their property, do something with their property, and then go to initially relocation centers near their home before they were finally sent out to the 10 different internment camps.
Across the country,
but primarily in the more western states.
Yeah, and after, as of March, when the Public Law 503, which gave the War Department the sort of authority to then take over the situation, and then as of April, in major cities, they started to post those sort of famous posters that we've seen that all people of Japanese ancestry had to report to these civil centers, and that's where they were sort of taken in and given numbers, and then they were sent by bus typically to assembly centers and then processed.
I'm going to ask you, Suzanne, and Rob, I know your parents were in Hawaii and had a much different experience than many other Japanese Americans and those of Japanese descent during this time. But to talk a little bit about the personal impact, Suzanne, let's start with you and have you talk about how did your family react when it got the news that it was going to be interned?
Do you want me to talk and from the perspective of a child? 6.5 years old.
I mean, what do you remember from this
okay,
time?
At age six, this is what I remember. I remember two gentlemen who were FBI agents, and they came to our house on Vashon Island, and they said, they were very apologetic. They said, sorry, we have to search your house. We have to go up to the attic. We want to know if you have hunting rifles, radios, if you have a radio. We're going to confiscate that. And they even looked in the kitchen at the various sizes of the knives. So if it was a certain length of a knife, then they took it.
And when did your family move into one of the camps?
Well, actually, it was in the spring after Pearl Harbor. So that would be 1942. And we were sent to Pinedale Assembly Center, which was in California, very close to Fresno, in the summer. And, you know, well, if you've ever been to Fresno in the summertime, it can be 102 degrees. And for the elderly from Washington and Oregon, it was very, very difficult because it was so uncomfortable for them. You know, the quarters, the food, you know, it was very, very difficult for the older generation.
What was daily life like in the camps? I mean, what were you allowed to do and not allowed to do?
Well, in the assembly center, I think we were there maybe only a month or two, but then later we were all moved to Northern California, to Tula Lake. And oh my, it was so dusty there. You know, former lake dried up, and they had hastily put up barracks for us, and the wind just blew in the cracks, and then in the winter we all had these pot-bellied stoves because it was freezing cold, and each family had a space of about 20 feet, and sometimes if you had a family of four, like my family, you had to even share it with maybe a newlywed couple or an elderly couple. So, you know, you'd have six people in a very small space.
Rebecca, based on your research, tell us more about the conditions and some of those rules, if you can.
Well, I think that probably my colleagues here have better information there.
Well, Rob, I know that you've been digitizing oral histories of what life was like for some Japanese Americans in these camps. What have you heard that's struck you?
You know, oddly enough, there was a great attempt to achieve some kind of normalcy, as odd as that sounds. So they set up schools, they had Boy Scouts, they had dances, they had, you know, they tried to recreate as much as they could of American society. The irony did not escape people, you know, the fact that school started with students saying, you know, Pledge of Allegiance, and the barbed wire fencing is outside of the classroom windows, and there's, you know, guard towers. So they're talking about their rights, and it was very odd. But, you know, there are a lot of reports of the fact that they tried to set things up to achieve this normalcy. So,
Now, Rob, as we mentioned before, your parents were in Hawaii during this time, and they had a much different experience. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Luckily for them, so approximately 40% of the Hawaiian population at that time was Japanese. So a lot of them had come over because the sugarcane fields had sent boats over to Japan and said, we have work. Like, if you need work, you know, to come to the islands. And so there were large populations that migrated to Hawaii. So with 40% of the population of Hawaii as being Japanese, it was very difficult to round up that kind of percentage. So even though there was talk of it, there were a few thousand that because they were highly suspected as being maybe having some allegiance to Japan, they were sent to the West Coast to be interned. But on the whole, it was not a possibility. So my family, my father was six and my mother was one, so not many memories for her. But my father was actually outside in the backyard playing ball when the attacks on Pearl Harbor happened. So he recalls the planes, which were flying low, headed over. And my grandmother apparently thought they were filming a movie. So she said, oh, isn't that great? They're filming a movie. and it wasn't until much later that they figured out what was actually happening. So, but there was a lot of fear at the time because there was uncertainty, and getting rid of things that were Japanese was something that people started to bury items or burn items or get rid of them. Because they just didn't know. But luckily, my grandfather had a lot of connections, so they were able to sort of steer clear of any problems. But it was a very terrifying time.
We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment. I'm speaking with Suzanne Sakahara, Rob Miyasaka, and Rebecca Copeland. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And now back to our conversation with Suzanne, Rob, and Rebecca about Japanese internment during World War II. I want to go back to you, Suzanne. You said before, when I asked you to tell us about your experience and your family's experience in an internment camp, about talking about it from the perspective of a six-year-old. Years later, looking back at that experience that your family endured, what do you make of all of it? What do you feel?
When you're a child, you're playing all the time, and you don't realize, you know, the ramifications of such a horrendous thing that's happened to your family. So we just tried to carry on from with daily life and play with each other. And as far, you know, I think it was like living in a microcosm of the outside world, because, as Rob said, you know, schools were established and hospitals. And piano lessons, and Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts. I think I was a brownie at one time.
I was a brownie dropout.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But we had to eat in mess halls together, and there was a community, you know, bathhouse. But we tried very hard to live a normal life. Now, Japanese people tend to be very private. And this was a strange experience for them, because suddenly they were there with hundreds of other people, strangers that they'd never met before. And, oh, you can imagine how the teenagers felt. They could go from block to block, you know, having a great time. So as a young child between the ages of 6 and 9, you know, my perspective, you know, would be very different from my parents if they were still here. For me, I think it was fun. That's a terrible thing to say. Do you want me to go on?
But from a child's perspective, yeah. I can understand that.
You can understand that?
But when you think back on it today, how do you reflect on that?
Oh, I feel so sorry for the elderly people, the Issei, the first generation, my grandparents. And also my parents, you know, we're loyal to the United States. You know, what are we doing here? What happened to my uncle, who happened to be very active in the community in Washington? But he was an alien, so he was sent off to another camp in Idaho as a suspicious person.
Wow. I'll be honest, in reviewing this history in preparation for our program today, I will admit that there were parts of the history I just didn't know about. I wonder, do you feel like this is getting the history of the internment camps and what Japanese Americans and those of Japanese ancestry went through is getting taught in our schools effectively?
I don't think it's being taught at all in many schools. I mean, I'm quite older than most school children today, obviously, but it was never part of my history lesson. And I grew up on the East Coast, and it may be that students on the West Coast have a different sort of history, but I don't think it's part of everyday history in the United States.
Rob, as a playwright and someone who is working on these oral histories, what are your thoughts?
Well, certainly. I mean, even to, like, last year, I went down to McGee, Arkansas, which is sort of a town, not necessarily a large town, but is a town between Jerome and Roer. So those were the two sites of the internment camps in Arkansas. And so I was able to visit the site of Roer and visit the museum. And when I came back, you know, I had told people what I had done. And it was very interesting to see how many people had no idea that there were internment camps in Arkansas. They were like, where in Arkansas? And I said, well, there was one in Jerome, there was one in Roer. And
when I told them, you know, Jerome had 8,500 people, and so did Jerome. So there were almost 17,000 Japanese interned in Arkansas alone, and people just had no idea. So, I mean, certainly, and just doing the research and talking about it, how many people have sort of no idea as to what really happened and how and why as well.
One of the things that I learned about, again, in preparation for this program, was that there were ways that Japanese Americans from the West Coast were able to leave internment or avoid it altogether. And there's a St. Louis connection. And Suzanne, I also know that this was how your family left internment camps. Let's start with you, Rebecca, to talk about that local connection here.
Well, certainly when the internments began in 1942, university presidents and chancellors throughout the West Coast were just terrified about what was happening to their students, to their Japanese American students, and wrote to the president to try to get some kind of concession for these students. The president actually handed this off to his wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, and she had never been in favor of the camps and was concerned that people would be afraid, Japanese Americans would be afraid that these were going to be permanent, as had happened to Native Americans. And so she worked with the Quaker Society and with other members of the War Relocation Authority to create a sort of reset, a relocation program of her own, relocating students from the West Coast to universities and colleges in the Midwest and East Coast. And so over 600 colleges and universities participated in this. Washington University was one. And even before the relocation of students became codified, Washington University had already admitted about 15 or so students from the West Coast and from Hawaii to help them continue with their education.
What would we have lost had these universities not done this?
I think this is one of the tragedies that we see happening now, too, is the loss of brilliant minds. These are students, these are young people who are in the prime of their intellectual development, who would have had to put all of that brilliance on hold. And in the case of our community, we gained a tremendous asset in a number of the students who came to Washington University and stayed. And I think probably one of the most famous is Mr. Gio Obata, who has been a tremendous member of the St. Louis community.
We're also going to hear more about the personal experience of another student, Dick Henme, who was able to leave an internment camp after being accepted by WashU in just a few minutes. But first, Suzanne, I want you to talk about how your family was able to leave the internment camp.
Well, the irony is that my family was accepted by the commanding officer of Jefferson Barracks, Colonel Anderson, and we lived in his three-story big mansion.
Now, this was part of a method in which
we had sponsorship.
Families sponsored families who Japanese American families.
So no longer did I have to be in a elementary school in Montana where the children were saying, "Oh, Jap, you're a sap," you know, that sort of thing. Because the children at Jefferson Barracks all went to the Afton School District. They were bused there. Well, you can be sure that word got around, you better not make fun of that little girl because she is living with the commanding officer of Jefferson. So we were safe.
What was the experience for Japanese Americans in St. Louis? What was it like? Was it particularly racially hostile?
My mother's cousin, Fuji, said, "Don't worry, if you don't want to go back to the West Coast, come to St. Louis. There's no prejudice against Japanese here. You'll feel safe." So my parents brought my little sister, left me with my grandparents in Wyoming at a second Heart Mountain place of incarceration. And then the three of them came to St. Louis and they built a life for themselves. My dad did not want to return to the West Coast, even though he had a 70-acre farm, and he was cheated out of it because a deputy sheriff was supposed to take care of it and to send some money to I think there were five farmers involved in that, and he didn't do it. So my dad said, "Nope, we're not going back. We're going to make St. Louis our home."
Let me ask you this, Rob. Is this a sentiment that you are also hearing in the oral histories that you're digitizing?
I think there was always an apprehension among the Japanese, and they, felt more secure in their own communities. So certainly whether or not they faced sort of open discrimination, I'm sure there's some of that, and there's some description of that. I don't know that it was aggressive, probably certainly not as much as it was on the West Coast. I mean, even after the war, when people returned, there was a strong sentiment that they didn't want them back, and that would have been much more difficult. But I don't think it was to that degree here.
And my understanding is that when people were allowed to leave the camps in Arkansas, that many did come to St. Louis?
Because they were given train tickets and $25 to go anywhere they want, a lot of them who were going west actually took trains from Arkansas to St. Louis, and then in Union Station, then they took trains west. There were quite a few families that decided at that point that maybe that's not the best idea. So there were several hundred families that actually decided to stay and locate here in St. Louis.
This might be a simple sounding question, but I'm hoping we can get into some of the nuance of it. How is this period of history in the U.S. viewed today? I mean, is it universally condemned, or are there people who are still arguing that the country did, quote, what needed to be done at that time? I'll let anyone want to step
well,
up?
Well, some people would say maybe it was for the safety of Japanese American citizens and Japanese aliens on the three, you know, in the three West Coast states. Maybe the fact that because, you know, there were businesses that were, you know, burnt, for example. There's a lot of violence and hatred. And so one excuse was, well, maybe they're lucky. At least they were safe. What do you think of that?
Well, the word you used, excuse, is a telling one. Rebecca, you looked like you wanted to jump in there.
Well, I think that not all Japanese Americans were not all went into the camps as easily as everyone. And there were people who resisted, and they were brought to trial, the famous one being the trial of Korematsu. This law has never been repealed, and it's still on the books, the law that denied him his rights. And it's still being used by politicians today to justify prejudice of this kind. So I think that the incident is something that we look back on as being horrible, but other people can also look back on it as a model.
I do know that the U.S. government under President Ronald Reagan issued a formal apology as well as issuing reparations to each of the surviving internees. Rob, let me ask you, in your place, how have you addressed this legacy of this dark period?
You know, one of the things I think with my research that I have really tried to do is when I place myself during that time period and to really understand the hysteria that was involved. And certainly, I think having lived through the wake of 9/11, and there was a certain degree of hysteria at that time. And maybe that incident helped me to understand what happened after Pearl Harbor. I mean, that sense of just shock and betrayal and anger, in terms of justifying it, I guess I just have to recognize that at that time, between the outcry from the military and from the media and from politicians, I mean, that West Coast was incredibly fearful of an attack on the West Coast. I mean, if Japan had gotten as far as Hawaii, there was nothing to say that they weren't going to keep coming to the coast. And that was a much scarier prospect. So justification, certainly I'm not justifying what happened, but I think in reading all of what happened and the confusion and panic, I certainly can see where that kind of thing can explode and become sort of out of control.
And so then what caution would you give to us today in the world we find ourselves in, where there are national security threats, where there are regions of the world that are very unstable? What lessons can we draw from this period of how we should proceed as a nation in terms of treating our own citizens and those who have immigrated to the United States?
I think that concept of the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, and really when saner minds are lost and reason is, we leave all reason, that's when we fall prey to all kinds of seemingly awful acts, like when we look back at what actions we've taken. But I think that concept of when we allow fear to take over our rational side, that's when we need to check ourselves.
I agree. I think that the trumpeting of fear is one way that we make ourselves more vulnerable, in fact, to security issues. And let's not forget that when we were at war with Japan, we were also at war with two other nations. And natives of our immigrants from Germany and Italy were not interned to the extent that Japanese Americans were interned. There were some rounded up and investigated. Most of them were ethnic Germans or Italians. So I think that we have to remember that much of this was racially motivated. We are displacing our fear off on people that look different, sound different, perhaps dress differently, and it's one way of managing our fear.
I was thinking about another deciding factor that, especially in California, it was the Japanese farmers who were providing so much competition to the white farmers. And this was a good chance to get the Japanese out of California. I think that was a large part of the decision, too.
Well, I want to say thank you so much, Suzanne Sakahara, Rob Miyasaka, and Rebecca Copeland. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.